Thank you all for attending this session. So I'm Jenny Lyon, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm going to chair this session, introduce Alan. I'll hand over to him, and then really I think because we're a relatively small group, if you want to ask questions as we go through, that's fine, but similarly we'll aim to have some discussion at the end, hopefully. So, Alan is a director of Towers Watson Insurance Consulting in the Asia-Pacific region. He's based in Singapore, and he's had a broad-ranging career. So he's had both consulting and corporate roles in financial services, trained as an actuary, but more recently he's been working in general management. Before joining Towers Watson early in 2013, he was CEO for the large, successful Indonesian subsidiary of an international financial services group. And in his consulting roles, he's helped organisations with the development of their businesses in the Asia-Pacific region. He's lived and worked in Australia, Asia and Europe, so he's got plenty of knowledge across all of financial service, basically, and he's going to give us some great insight into Aussies and Asia. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Jenny. So I think the short version of that is jack of all trades and master of none. But thanks for that introduction. I took a lot of effort writing it, and it's very long-winded. I have to do a test first of all. How many people in the room are amongst the 25 people who are visiting from Asia? Good. So I should preface, if you're asking questions about markets in Asia, I think you should ask these guys, not me. I'm not going to go too deeply into each of the markets, and anybody who's worked a little bit in Asia knows that Asia is not Asia. Asia is a collection of a whole lot of different places. But I've been around probably a bit longer than most people in the room, and again, my CV sounds wonderful, but I think it doesn't mean I'm older and wiser. It just means I've seen a few more things than most people. And I've been involved in Asian markets since the early 1990s, so that's 20-plus years. And I've seen a lot of change. The biggest change I've seen is massive growth in the insurance industries across all of the markets in Asia. Well, not all, but most of the markets in Asia. And unfortunately, what I've also seen, and I'll show you this later, is a diminishing activity of Australian insurers in that part of the world. So what I want to do today is give you a bit of a feel for what Aussies aren't doing and what they might be missing out on. I'm going to talk a little bit about the markets generally, give you a picture of what's going on in Asia, a very broad brush, but hopefully leave you with a sense of the opportunity that exists. And I'll do it from a corporate point of view, but underneath it you should all be thinking, well, if there's corporate opportunity, there's probably individual opportunity for smart people to do more. And really leave you with a question that isn't so much hopefully why, but why not? Why aren't we there, either as companies or as individuals? Now, that, someone at the back, can you read every single number on that? Absolutely not. Good. Because they may not be right. No. The point of this, there are some colours on the slide, and that's the most important thing. I've got some slightly debatable labels, but the red boxes... Where's that microphone going? The red boxes I've labelled the too lates. You know, if you're not in there, it may be too late. The blue boxes are the get in now because there's a lot happening, you should be there, and if you're not, get moving quickly. And the green boxes are countries which at a very high level are sort of, if you're not there as a company, you can probably wait. Although I'd say you should wonder how long you should wait. And there are a couple of things I want to point out. Each of these slides has got the GDP of the country, big numbers, hard to work out. The growth of the country, more interestingly, the population and the gross written premium. And the measures vary a little bit by country, so it's a bit hard to get a handle on. Probably the most interesting things are Australia. Pretty big market. Pretty crappy growth. And pretty small population by the standard of most things on the table. Now, you've probably heard lots about India and China, and you've probably heard lots of good stories and bad stories about people there, but they're big markets, lots of players.
gone through quite a lot of revolution, and I've put them in this sort of maybe it's getting now category. On the top right, you've got a few, and there's some down the bottom of the possibly too late, you know, fairly developed markets. Singapore and Hong Kong are ultimately quite small places. The populations are small, although we're constantly doing work for people wanting to come into those markets as well. So it's not out of the question. But a couple you may not realise, most people have heard of Bali, but a lot of people are beginning to realise Bali is part of a much bigger country called Indonesia, with 250 million people compared to Australia's there 22 million. Did you know that Thailand has 64 million people? Myanmar? Where the hell's Myanmar? Been there as a tourist, maybe. Only 64 million people. So there are some really big places, and the growth rates, if you look at some of these growth rates, most of them are in the 6%+ region in GDP terms, again compared to Australia at 3.6. So just off that slide, the relative size, relative growth, you got to go, wow, we're living in this place that we like, and it's interesting, but it's small and it's growing slowly, and we have a tough time here. This slide actually illustrates a couple of things. There's what we've got on one axis is the GDP per capita. So, you know, your underdeveloped countries are down this end of the x-axis. I still remember some of the mathematical stuff. And then we've got life insurance penetration rates. And again, quality of data, getting this sort of stuff is a bit difficult. But what we tried to do is sort of map what had happened between 2002 to 2012. And the bubble sizes, if you like, size of the industry, essentially. Size of the industry. So, you know, the big ones, Japan was big, was rich, was reasonably well penetrated and hasn't changed very much. But you've got places like Indonesia, which is this one, which actually is still not very wealthy, but notice the scales are quite different as well. Indonesia has actually changed quite a bit and the market's grown quite a lot over 10 years roughly. So the sort of this is the way we think of the opportunity, is how much is the country growing and therefore the opportunity for people to be able to afford insurance, but also potentially the need matching GDP per capita, but also what is the penetration rate of insurance. So again, it's an opportunity view, and it says there are still lots of places. So if you assume that countries are going to grow in terms of GDP per capita over time, we would say they're probably going to follow this path where penetration should go up as well, because that's what we can see broadly in the map if you look at various different countries. Does that make sense? Yeah? Maybe it should have been a coffee break before this meeting. So what has been happening is, again, impressive growth. So Australia, again, you probably can't read it. This is Australia. So the last 4 or 5 years, 5%. And I think most people are probably not too unhappy about that. This is life insurance. I know you've got the issues of insurance, managed funds, superannuation. All the categories are a bit different by market. But there are lots of developed, Hong Kong, Singapore, and underdeveloped and emerging markets that are growing much faster, have been growing much faster than Australia. So again, if one of the things you want is growing earnings streams, well, there's plenty of places there that seem to have faster growth in premium, and as long as you can make money off that premium, then should be faster growing in terms of earnings. A bit of a picture, this is a confusing one. We went through all of our snapshots of different markets to look at where a product's going. And my whole career, there haven't been really traditional products sold in Australia, whole of life and endowment. I think everyone who does the actuarial exam still probably learns what a whole of life product is. But it's only relevant for Asia. It's not really relevant for Australia. This is a very simple picture of a few different markets. And what I'm trying to illustrate here is how dynamic it is. Now, broadly, there is a move towards investment-linked products. And I might come back briefly to that or have a debate over coffee or something. However, there's some unusual things. And you've got some massive shifts. So this is the percentage of new business premium between traditional products, so whole-of-life, endowment, term insurance type stuff, and investment-linked products, you know, the stuff that was sold in Australia for many, many years. And you can see the mix within life insurance in some of these markets has changed dramatically. Anyone know what's gone on in India? Now, let me tell you, it's not consumers, it's regulator. So when you think of regulator inputs, the Indian regulator has completely overturned and in very short, very fast pace, massive changes in changing the way the regulation encourages investment link, makes profitable or unprofitable for companies to provide it, created a whole lot of extra burdens. So the market has basically shifted back to traditional business. And it's quite funny because it's not that long ago that everybody wanted to be in India, and there are a few companies that were going, oh, why can't we get in, why can't we get in? And they're probably sitting back going, maybe it's not so bad that we weren't in India at the time. Hong Kong and Singapore are also quite interesting because they're bucking the trend, if you like, of move towards investment-linked, unit-linked products. They're still traditional. I think it's a different story there. I think it's actually the bit the story in Australia of product or solutions moving out of the insurance industry and moving more into mutual funds and investment houses. So it's people no longer using traditional products as a savings vehicle, but starting and not using life insurance. So even though unit-linked products are available, starting to move into different vehicles. Hong Kong is a bit unusual again because, again, the regulator has done some very interesting things with life insurance companies and banks selling product and not selling the product because of the product, but selling the product through the TV screen that came when you bought the product. And so the regulator, for example, on if a bank sells a life an investment-linked product, they actually have to record it, you have to go into their office, you have to sit and go through this massive disclosure process, and the banks have basically said, forget it, we're not interested. So again, regulators have a big impact. The other big impact, though, is companies, and capital regulations on companies drive their interests. And you know, we heard a presentation on economics, and capital regimes tend to be harsher on products that have guarantees. Surprise, surprise. The traditional products are coming under pressure in many markets, more for the foreigners than the local companies. The local companies sometimes haven't yet worked out what economic volatility and lower interest rates mean, but the foreign companies know what it means, know about the capital charges, and therefore have moved away. The point is a lot of change. You know, again, you have to be ready for the change. So that's a little bit what's been happening. Let me move on to what's going on now. These are all fairly obvious to anyone who observes a little bit. You've got what lots of people call a demographic multiplier or a socio-eco-demographic multiplier, with the middle class growing in many of these places, a young and growing populations in many places, not shrinking populations, and growing wealth in the hands of the population as well. So, you know, Indonesia is one of my favourite markets. I've worked there twice. Simple example. Anyone know how many new cars are sold in Indonesia every year? No? Guess? That's a bit aggressive. 1 million. Motorbikes, however, 8 million. And I think you see them on the road every day in Jakarta, all those new motorbikes. Now, but the reason I raise that, for me, that's the most tangible example of growing wealth. And it's not people buying actually a luxury good. It's the people that are struggling with the traffic. There's virtually no public transportation. So it's people who are buying a motorbike because they can now afford to use that to get to work to earn money. A lot of it's coming through loans, so that's the banking system is quite developed. But that's the sort of thing that's going on here. You know, moving into the urban, so people moving into Jakarta, again, is one example, but that's happening in KL and other places as well. Asians are also better than Australians at saving. They're also better than Australians at, when things are tough, pulling back a little bit. So when I was in Hong Kong living there in 2007, 2008, 2009, and everybody around the world started talking about how the problems were, in Australia, if you had a job, you sort of went, oh, things are fine. If you didn't have a job, it was tough. In Hong Kong, if you have a job, you still cut back. You know, you prepare for things to be worse. That's the way the Hong Kong consumer thinks. So higher savings ratio, a bit more preparation, a bit more thinking. And You know, things like smartphones, gadgets, technology, the take-up is amazing. BlackBerry made a huge amount of money because of its Indonesian business. The BlackBerry device was the device up till relatively recently. So, you know, even though landlines are less penetrated, things like smartphones have taken off in many markets. So a lot of dynamics that are underpinning this growth and the fundamentals. The reason people save is different, and I've just got very simply just a couple of examples of China and India. The pattern, like Australia, people typically wait till they get a bit older and then they start thinking about saving for retirement, and as somebody said this morning, it's typically too late. But again, the point is people do save more in a lot of the Asian countries than at least on the statistics comparing savings rate Australia versus Asia. They do differ, so you can see some differences there around the importance or the thinking of children's expenses. And in most of Asia, children's education policies, essentially a repackaged unit-linked product or a repackaged endowment product, are fairly standard and very interesting. It targets the needs. In Australia, that same product would just be a standard product, but typically it'd be the financial advisor trying to talk about the needs rather than the insurer packaging the product towards the needs that people have. The other thing is that, again, country by country, you have to think about it. So in Muslim countries, you know, it's relatively popular to have another item in here, which is not wedding or education. It's Hajj, saving for the Hajj or your pilgrimage to Mecca. And it's a great reason to have a savings policy because Islamic fundamentals say that once in your lifetime you should do the trip to Mecca. So creating a savings policy that helps people do that is actually a really neat thing to do that people want. So, again, you can't just take what you do in Australia and port it over, and you can't just take what you happen to have been successful in Hong Kong at and say it'll work in Indonesia. But, again, there's saving and there's data and there are customers that are looking for solutions. Retirement. So, again, you need to understand the customers, but it's quite clear there are big problems. So this is just another cut of some of the data that was described for Australia. I like this one because this is what we were talking about this morning in the plenary, but this is the gap between retirement age and life expectancy. And retirement age is the sort of, you know, where the pension or the old age security cuts in most of the countries. But it essentially says there's a big gap. And interestingly, the gap, this is the gap in Australia, and you can see the gap is even bigger in some of the less developed countries. Now, maybe one element of closing that gap will be raising the retirement age from 55 to 60 to 65 for pension benefits. But at the same time, a lot of these countries' life expectancy is going up as health and lifestyle factors change. So the gaps may not shrink that much. The other thing, the dependency ratio, or at least the over 65 portion of the dependency ratio, fast growing in all of these places and another piece of evidence for a need for solutions. So how well is the coverage provided? Well, this is a bit of an illustration of the formal pension systems and where they are and where they aren't. And you've got Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, pretty good. And then you've got some really big places that really don't have much of a formal pension system at all. So you saw the problem before, and you can see that problem isn't being solved by governments and by formal systems, opening the opportunity for people like us to solve the problems, which is what we've done in Australia for years. Now, Hong Kong, I've chosen this example where there is a formal system and the MPF authority, the Mandatory Provident Authority, which is the regulator for the mandatory provident scheme, is very proud of the 98% coverage of the Hong Kong population. This is an illustration of the gap between sort of what you'd expect to need in retirement versus what you will get if you're in this system for your whole life. And we've just chosen median salary level person, 2x median and the 3x median person. And what it says is that there's basically still almost 40% gap for the median income earner in Hong Kong, where there is 100% coverage in a mandatory system between what those people will end at retirement date, what they would expect to have from the system, versus what they need. And that gap gets bigger as, actually the middle one's wrong, but the bottom one, the gap gets bigger as you have a higher salary, obviously because there's a cap on it. So even where there are systems in place, those systems aren't sufficient. Now again, Hong Kong people are good savers, there are systems and there's the other pillars of saving outside the formal system, but that's again the opportunity for the insurers, the life insurers, to come and play and solve those problems. And then people say, yeah, but are there really any people with money? Well, there are people with money. There are lots of people, and even if it's a small proportion of people that actually make up the portion with money, that's a lot of people. So, sure, there are big problems, there are big gaps, but can people afford it? Well, yes. The answer is yes. And, you know, just some interesting ones. 30% of the world's high net worth individuals are accounted for in Asia Pacific. And interestingly, a chunk of them are in Malaysia and Indonesia, and they go to Singapore to buy their products. There is a lot of wealth, although I would say that the target market is not necessarily the very wealthy, it's the mass. And even though the wealthy by Asian standards are quite large now, about probably the size of the addressable Australian population, the next layer of the mass, which are people in Asia that can afford insurance today, is a very large number. So, yes, there's a marketplace. I'm going to... What time are we supposed to finish this? So I've still got 10 minutes to talk. Okay. I'm going to skip through this and the next slide very quickly. Distribution's changing. So when I first started working in Asia, Australians were sending their old tired agency managers out to run businesses in Asia, and it was working. And the history of Asia is essentially tired life insurance agents selling products. That shifted dramatically, and what we've seen is much more emerging dominance and continuing dominance of what we call partnership distribution. And partnership distribution, just to describe it on the next slide, includes bank assurance, so it's actually banks signing up with an insurer, either an owned insurer or a joint venture partner or an exclusive arrangement, to sell products through bank branches. But we also consider the sort of independent financial advisor or brokers, as they're sometimes called in other markets, and even direct, as sort of non-aligned, if you like. The big growing area is bank assurance, and just to give you an illustration again of the size of this, I know that here a number of the big life insurers are owned by banks, but in Asia that integration of the banking and the life insurance sales process is actually much stronger. There's nowhere near as much proper financial planning in most markets in Asia, so that's quite different. But the second biggest life insurer in Indonesia is AXA Mandiri, which actually goes back to the old National Mutual days for some of the people with the grey hair or the lack of hair like me. Just to give you order of magnitude, it's got a few hundred million of annual premium equivalent new business every year. So this is a big business by any standard, number two in the market, and it's an exclusive joint venture between a bank and an insurance company. So that's one of the areas that's got a lot of growth. And again, interestingly, financial planning, independent financial advisors, or even financial advisors, forget independent or not, objective financial advice doesn't exist in most of these markets. So I'm sort of dropping hints along the way of things that I think Australia's good at that could be taken to Asia, much as Australians used to take tied agency people to Asia. So why did I call it the $2 trillion prize? Well, because what we've done is looked at GDP per capita, looked at expected growth, looked at penetration, and predicted where we think these markets will go to. And we think they'll head to roughly $2 trillion in new business premium by the year 2025. So does that sound like a large number? Yes, well, it is. And it's, you know, we talk about Asia giants, North Asia and Southeast Asia. They're all growing very strongly. They're all going to be sizable populations. You've got a bit of a mixture of already developed and emerging markets in each of those. But this is big business, and it's getting bigger, and it's going to be enormous. So some solutions. We ask every year, I think, Mark, you've attended one of these sessions in Hong Kong. We ask a few times with some of our clients, if you could buy in the top five, not worrying about capital and whether you can buy or can't buy, where would you buy? And the point here is, I don't see any Australian clients coming to me saying, come, how do I enter Indonesia? I see lots of people from everywhere else. And this is what they're saying. So we asked first in May 2011, and it was China, India and Indonesia, a little bit Korea, Malaysia. We asked again later that year. Indonesia had moved up a bit, China had come down a bit. Flick forward another 6 months or so. Whoa, Indonesia's gone crazy. A little bit of, well, other people are doing deals. There were quite a few big public deals here. So probably other people saying, oh, maybe I should be there. But China had also come down quite a bit, and there's a lot of stories about difficulties of operating. India plummeted. Remember I talked about regulatory changes? Well, basically everybody said, well, this is a place that's going to be hard work for a while. Hong Kong was going through difficulties in economic environment, particularly interest rates. But Indonesia was the big story. And it did come back a bit. And potentially that's people getting a bit nervous about price. But you can see the key places are those ones. We're beginning to see much more interest in Vietnam and the Philippines, and they were on my, you know, you've got a little bit of time but you should be thinking about it now slides. And our clients in Asia are, if they're not there, they're looking at the next ones on the list. The ones that are already there are trying to expand in those markets plus new ones. I'm going to show you a short video. It's about 4 minutes, I think.
In a world of 7 billion people, there will never be another you, because only you can be there for those who love you most. That's why providing protection alone just isn't enough, and why we're doing all we can to help you live healthier, better, and longer. Introducing the LiveGreat program. It's a holistic health and wellness program designed to help you live healthier every day by making it easier and more affordable. Here's how it works. First, log in to livegreat.greateasternlife.com and take a wellness profiling. It's free, and it takes just a few minutes to find out how healthy you really are. Second, declare your intention to improve that area of your health. And for that extra push, dedicate that intention to the one who matters most to you. Third, learn all you can about how best to achieve your goals by browsing the helpful tips, articles, and recipes on the site. You'll also find information about any upcoming workshops and events that can help you in your efforts. Next, make use of all the tools we have to offer, such as the 21 Days mobile app and more, to keep you on track towards your intentions. On top of that, you'll enjoy exclusive privileges every step of the way by using your LiveGreat card at health and wellness establishments across Southeast Asia. Above all else, this journey is about one simple thing, helping you be here longer for the ones who need you in their lives. And that's what matters most to us. Because we're not just a life insurance company anymore. We're a life company.
So what do you think of that?
No reactions?
In Australia? Well, sort of, except the regulations make it really hard to do this. So community rating in Australia stops this type of stuff happening properly, because this is all about starting to price people as individuals, provide them better benefits, and, you know, I was involved in a company trying to do this in Australia, and it's really hard. But yeah, this is really cool. I mean, it's cool from a number of issues. They're trying to change behaviour. They're changing their image and branding. So that last thing, we're not a life insurance company. We don't pay when you die. We try and help you live longer with your family. Now, ultimately, they are solving the financial problem. But they're also using technology from today, social connections, you know, the dedicated to your wife thing, really neat sort of marketing stuff. So
And this isn't some two-bit little company. Some of you who work in Asia will have heard of Great Eastern. They're like number one or two in Singapore and Malaysia. AIA, anyone from AIA here in the room? Yeah, so Vitality, very similar story. Not sure how much that's happening in Australia, but the same type of concept of trying to create behavioural change and packaging and also changing the image of insurance. So there's a whole lot of stuff in that that's really interesting, and you know, there are not too many Australian companies doing that sort of thing, but it's a sign that you can innovate in Asia and start to change the way the game is played. It also does mean don't just sit back and assume that stuff you do here will work. Interestingly, that's some stuff that I think could play differently here. This is sort of already happening, event-based marketing using bank databases to target campaigns as relevant. So, you know, the basic simple example is find out when the credit card transaction showed buying nappies repeatedly but for the first time. Bang, a baby's happened. That's probably a good time to offer some simple over-the-phone term insurance. So this is not terribly new. Some companies are doing it in Australia, but it's certainly happening in Asia and just beginning. So the companies that are doing that sort of stuff in Australia can still bring it as a competitive advantage in Asia. There's some interesting disruptors. So anyone heard of Tony Fernandez? So here's the sort of Asia Richard Branson almost. AirAsia, the sort of challenger brand around airlines, has a subsidiary called Tune. Tune does groovy hotels, but it also does Tune Money. And you'll notice this is their website. It's very clean, very clear. It doesn't look at all like your traditional life insurer website. Essentially, when you buy an AirAsia ticket, you have to opt out, firstly, which is interesting from privacy and whether you think that's fair. But it makes it very easy to just buy the travel policy as you purchase your air ticket. But they're also expanding. So, you know, that's the list of countries that they're already operating in. And their first offer is a simple travel insurance, but they're moving to personal accident and they're starting to offer more life insurance type of products. So disruptors coming to play. And that's happening in Australia, no different. But there are people looking to bring new solutions. So affinity marking is one of those. There are some pictures of some mobile apps. They're actually all related to pension funds, mutual funds, investment-linked products, and it's basically engaging the customer. So it's things like being able to find out what your balance is, find out the fund's growth, look at what's happened with the unit prices, do illustrations and returns. Again, not necessarily to sell, although in that example they rolled it out to agents first so that agents had a tool to talk to customers about, but it's now in the hands of customers. So again, a little bit of engaging customers with things that are relevant to them. So stuff that's happening in Asia. So there's actually a lot happening, but there are lots of gaps. So firstly, let me do my whinge for the day. Back when I started working in Asia, all of these people were operating, and the heritage of AXA as a very big successful insurer in Asia is National Mutual of Australia, putting flags up in a number of countries. AMP had a go, Colonial, and interestingly, Commonwealth is one of the few last people standing. Is there anyone from Cominsure here? Yeah? So I think it's probably fair to say that that business is still there because they couldn't sell it during the financial crisis in Indonesia when they sold everything else that they had. I think there were 8 businesses acquired from the old Colonial Mutual that went up through the Pru Legal and General acquisitions. MLC was there. Interestingly, Legal and General was doing a lot of its Asia stuff from here, and ING, I haven't put there, was also doing a lot of its Asia stuff out of here or supported from here. So if you go back 20 years, the Australians were in Asia, and progressively they've pulled back. Now, there are a lot of Australian individuals still in Asia, some of them still hangovers like me, but a number of people moving out, a number of people studying in Australia and moving to Asia. But I find it a little bit sad that there aren't enough Australian organisations sitting there. So the real question is why, and you know, are there opportunities? I'm not going to go through all of this because of the time, but this is a simple example of Indonesia, and at the top I've got, you know, what are the gaps in the marketplace? What do I see from having run a business there as things where the market really isn't offering the best solutions or relative to the rest of the world, where are some of the solution gaps? And then what I've got is my view of what exists in Australia that could be opportunities. And, you know, there are some interesting things. I know people here complain no end about the regulator and the financial planning constraints and how much we have to do and tax and changing social security. The Australian market is really good at a couple of things that have really badly done in Asia. And if I combine platforms, wraps, funds, products, high productivity financial advice, those sorts of things just are done really badly in Asia generally. The level of sophistication of companies and the marketplace here is very, very high. You know, there are other things that, because of it needing to be more efficient on expenses, there's much more back office automation here, whereas in Asia a lot of companies are very large but they're still just using paper and people because paper and people are cheaper. That will change. So I think there are a lot of gaps that Australian companies can fill because they have this expertise. But again, today, they're not. And, you know, I've put up some things about what being in Asia for a company could be. I've done a little few phone interviews with people working for Australian companies to say, you know, what's your view on this? And, you know, some of those risks are there. There's uncertainty, you've got volatility. People are a bit worried about how much capital they'd have to commit, both capital to invest in terms of prudential standards, but also operating capital. You know, the fact that you have to set up a business, you have to hire people, and you know, management distraction, fair enough. I think one of the reasons that companies were pulling out is we've got some history of the banks when they expanded, not so much to Asia, but other places, having a few hiccups. And so shareholders can feel like expansion is a bit on the nose for many years. But the Australian banks are actually making a big play into Asia, but it's all about banking. It's not really about being insurance providers. So, you know, I think there are lots of positives. But this is a good one where I'd actually ask you guys, you know, what do you see? Why are your organisations not playing?
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you please just state your name and speak in the microphone?
Lindsay Mann. I worked for many years in Asia, but mainly on the, well, not mainly, in the funds management area. Mm. And I prepared a number of strategy-type position papers like this myself, and I know the big picture looks really good, but it nearly always comes down to what is the competitive edge that the Australian company can bring. Now, in funds management, there was practically no competitive edge that Australian companies had that they could take into Asia, and that's why you only see First State, Colonial First State up there, and to a lesser extent, Macquarie, a very opportunistic player.
AMP is doing a bit as
well. AMP, latecomers now coming in. But the thing that most people want are things that we're not good at. When people say, what are you, as an Australian fund manager, what are you good at? We're good at Australian equities and Australian fixed income. And nobody wants that. Yeah. In all my time up there, I never came across a request for someone to manage Australian equities or Australian fixed income. So you need to be a global-oriented business before you can be successful in Asia. Mm. And there aren't too many Australian financial institutions that have got that base yet. Now, I can't speak for banking and life insurance. Obviously, I was close to the CBA effort in Indonesia because we provided funds for them. And they seem to have been able to localise the business and think locally and do it well. But I don't think they were leveraging off their Australian business.
No,
I think it's very much local, all of these efforts. Anyway, this is just a few comments for you. I think that the opportunity looks fantastic, but I don't think Australian companies necessarily got the right base and skill sets that give them a competitive advantage up there.
So I'll just respond to that briefly. I tend to agree. However, when penetration in a market is down at 2 to 3%, actually the issue is not about whether you've got a competitive edge. And, you know, we do lots of work for entrants into the market, and they say, how bad's the competition? And nobody's actually asked what do the profit margins look like. The product margins for companies that have got some scale are really good in most markets. The answer is actually
at the retail end, most of these markets are not actually very competitive. The emerging markets are not. And so it's not, you have to know what you're doing in that market, but you don't actually have to be so much better than an AIA or a Manulife or an AXA that's been there for 10 years, because actually it's mostly about getting feet on the street. I'm not saying it's easy, because getting feet on the street in some of these markets is just hard work, and some of these companies have been at it for 20 years. But it's, I think that framework is a very Australian competitive market framework to take to Asia. It's, you know, competition's really tough, we need to find the edge. I'm going, well, actually, the under-penetration and the growth opportunities are so big that get in and have a go. And the biggest issue, I think, that comes up, though, is if you want it to be meaningful and you're a big business in Australia, how big is the bet that you're having to play to make it worth doing? And the management distraction for doing something, you know, Commonwealth is a good example where it's very low distraction. It runs itself. Simon Bennett's got it under control. He and I used to talk about, I was running a big Canadian company in the same market, and, you know, I theoretically had lots of access to resources and help, but I also had a huge amount of governance and reporting because of it being a global company. He'd go, I can't get any help, but I don't actually have to tell them much because I'm tiny in the scheme of things, so I'm pretty much left alone. Occasionally the audit guys come through and we tell them what we do and it's okay. So, yeah, but I guess my pushback is in many of these markets it's not yet that competitive that you really need something so different. But I do accept that the way shareholders in Australia think and the way senior management thinks is you have to have an edge, otherwise how could you win? So getting that story across is quite hard. Anyone else? Yeah, Mark.
Thanks, Alan. This has been fantastic. I mean, I'm working in a regional office for Zurich based in Hong Kong, and some of the questions you're asking, you know, are challenging, and they're things that we work through and other colleagues in similar positions and other companies are working through from a regional perspective. I think one key thing is return on equity, and I think Australian companies, including, of course, Australian banks, and more global companies are more ruthless about how they measure that and how they measure the time required to get to that scale where you can earn that return on equity. And for us as a newly growing company in Asia, having sold off many years ago some of what are successful companies now, that scale issue is a challenge.
Yeah.
And it takes time, and you're competing in many of the markets, particularly the established markets, Taiwan, Japan, Malaysia, Singapore to an extent, against local companies that probably don't have the same degree of shareholder ruthlessness and holding to account that we see, particularly with some of the products on offer in those companies, in those countries, and the guarantees available. So I think scale, return on equity are key things. I mean, we even hear ANZ being challenged, don't we, in the banking space around their expansion into Asia.
Yeah.
Just a few comments, thanks.
Yeah, really good comments, Mark. And you're right, a lot of the bigger success, the companies that are talking about profitable businesses and stories about how successful Asia is, a lot of them have been there a long time. And yes, you need some scale to get to that point. But the other side of that story is the product margins. And actually, 3 years ago in Australia, I might have had a problem talking about this, but I think most people in life insurance in Australia would be saying, boy, oh boy, life's tough here. We're not making much money. We're not returning much on our equity to shareholders. But the product margins and the returns available once you get to that scale are actually very high. And the other side of it is in 20 years, if you're not in there now, where are you going to be? And I can say that, you know, most of the multinationals entering, you know, a number of them are in that position that you talked about, and Mark, you talked about, that they haven't been in these markets, but they're starting to play. They're saying, let's get in there and have a go, and let's build something over time. The only other point is that in some of the markets where that local statutory requirements are very different to the global company's view of the world, actually Taiwan and Korea are good examples where a lot of the foreigners have just exited because they can't compete. But again, I go to places like Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, where that's not the case. And actually, again, it's not as competitive. So I think the Aussies have as much opportunity to play there as anywhere else. I think we've got 5 minutes from that bill. So, yeah. Other comments?
Yeah.
Yeah. More questions? I can take some questions. But
that's okay. I have a question for you. John Evans, with my Institute Council hat on. Slightly to the left field. That's a good growth story. It looks impressive. The question is when, not if. So we have 18% of our members resident in Asia now, roughly. What do you see as the opportunity for growth in that number? And secondly, assume it is going to increase or remain constant, what support should the Institute, what are they looking for in terms of support?
I'll move left because you asked a left field question. So I won't go into the big thing, but some really simple stuff. At the moment, there's a huge number of people from Asia who study in Australia and then go back to Asia. I haven't done the numbers, but my suspicion is a huge proportion of those people don't do the Australian exams. They finish Macquarie or Sydney or ANU, and then they swap and they do UK or US exams. It used to be because the US did multiple choice, and so people for whom English wasn't first language, it was easier. It's actually now apparently money. So we charge more for our exams, and substantially more, and a lot of companies in Asia refund at the end rather than pay up front. So, you know, some really simple stuff like, I can't believe we're trying to make money out of the students that leave Australia and actually getting, you know, really wanting them to pay the money to continue. I think that's an investment that every fellow would be happy to make with an incremental cost of fellowship fees compared to keeping more new members as active members of our institute. So that's a basic one that I've picked up. And, you know, a friend of mine who's moved to Malaysia as a Malaysian actuary that's never before worked in Malaysia after 30 years has said the first thing she did was went around and said to all the staff who had studied in Australia, are you doing the Australian exams? Are you doing the Australian exams? No. So there's a simple one. I think it's really tough. I mean, I see that we're doing lots of stuff on webcast, but do I get motivated to jump on? No. I'm personally doing some young actuaries programs in three countries, and there's the joint regional seminars that you would know about, Mark, but where the multiple institutes get together and do stuff. You know, another really interesting, APRA is looked at as the regulator by most of the Asian regulators. It's close. For some reason, I think the AusAid has done a lot of work with promoting Australian prudential regulation. And so there's lots of openings for us to do more, and we just seem to not quite get there. One answer might be to look a bit differently at which countries to target. Indonesia, I mean, I've got a personal bias, but Indonesia's huge and going to be even bigger. There's a massive lack of actuarial skills there, and I don't think there's... Yeah, well, and the regulator's doing some interesting things, like saying every company has to have a general insurance actuary, and there's one. And in fact, they're talking about dumbing down the requirements to allow people to meet the standard or the requirement, which actually doesn't make much sense either. But that's an example where nobody else is really trying hard to get in to none of the other institutes. If you think of it as a competitive environment, maybe we shouldn't, then the Australian Institute should actually have an advantage with that, although Australian and Indonesian politics go up and down like a yo-yo. I think still in the long term that's actually quite a good connection. So maybe it's a bit more about being strategic as to which market we focus on. I'm a bit mixed. I'm not sort of core actuarial, so I have a good feeling about the Institute personally and try and do stuff. But, you know, I think it's probably helping much more at the grassroots level of developing the junior people through, and you know, that's long term, not short term. But I think there's openings there.
Time for one more question.
I'm Randy Amidama from Zurich. I'm just wondering, it all sounds very dynamic and exciting, but what are some of the things that worry you most about some of those major markets? You know, we question our sustainability of the retail life sector here, but what sort of things would test the sustainability of those major markets, you think?
So very happy to pick that up more over the break. You've got a lot of volatility, just prudential. Personal story, sitting in Indonesia doing my risk report to our global head office in September, the risk report. I'm writing saying the capital regulations change as of the 1st of January next year. I will have to hold a different amount of capital. I have no idea what. Yeah. So stuff like that, which is, again, going to the comments over here, you sort of have to accept that that's the way it is and live with it and hope that it's not massively material or that it will be sensible in the way it works through. So the volatility and uncertainty in a number of them is probably the biggest. And there are some markets, the Philippines takes one step forward and two steps back and has over many years. So there are different markets that have different track records as well. The biggest single issue is none of these, though. It's talent. It's people. The ability to attract and retain people, and that's what pretty much every CEO is worried about. It's how do I find enough people to take advantage of that opportunity? And again, that's where I'd leave it and say Australia has great talent. And, you know, I'm not talking about me, but the people that we have here that could work in Asia. And, you know, I'd encourage you finally just have a think about it personally as well. I've been involved for 20 years and it's been a fantastic experience for me. But, you know, you do need to work out as companies what you want to do and how to play, but the opportunity's there. So, again, why not? Thank you.